In mid-October of 1977 at the University of California, Santa Cruz, a colloquium was held in honor of a visit by Dr. Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD. It was called LSD, A Generation Later. Among those present were John Lilly, Ralph Metzner, Allen Ginsberg, Stanley Krippner, Stephen Gaskin, David Smith, Irving Oyle, Ed Elkin, Timothy Leary, and a man who introduced himself as Richard Alpert. For a moment, it seemed like a time warp. There was Richard Alpert, associate of Dr. Timothy Leary at Harvard. Then we noticed that he was sitting cross-legged in his chair, and it was obvious that Ram Dass was addressing us, with a glint of cosmic humor in his eye. Ram Dass, the constantly evolving being who has introduced so many to extraordinary states of consciousness. Over a year ago, when he left New York City, we'd heard that he had gone to the Far East, to India. Then we heard that he was in Thailand, then Bali, then that he had returned to the United States. But it wasn't until this conference that we knew that he was once again among us. We took that opportunity in Santa Cruz to ask if he would come to San Francisco and spend an evening with the New Dimensions family and share with us his experiences of the past year, and through us, with you. He consented, and a few days later a number of us gathered informally, and we began our discussion by asking him his thoughts about the gathering that had just occurred in Santa Cruz. And this is what he said.
Was it happening? Just parenthetically, generally I don't think about it. I bet I don't think about much of anything that happened, because I find I get exhausted if I try to collect stuff. So it sort of was what it was. As such, I had a delightful weekend. Right, that's about what it was, a delightful weekend. It was simultaneously both important and trivial. It was certainly interesting to see people I hadn't seen in a long time. With very few of them do I feel I have much work to do. So in a way, it's like... It's in a way kind of an irrelevancy. Pleasant and delightful, but kind of an irrelevancy.
Almost like a high school reunion.
Like a high school reunion, yeah. Now, the other part of it is the way in which whatever responsibility is left concerning psychedelics in my life. And as such, my process was to come there, and when it came time for me to make my statement, to say, I took LSD last year in Bali, and this is what happened, and this is why I use it. But I don't feel like I'm in the role of being somebody who should be setting policy or anything like that, because that isn't really what my work is at this time. So I felt a very laid-back participation. There were some delightful moments in it. I mean, there was some delightful interplay with Timothy, and there was some delightful interplay with Stephen Gaskin, and Ralph Metzner and his wife and I went back and took about a two-hour hot tub together and did a lot of beautiful things about therapy and death and just a lot of very beautiful stuff. And that was a great joy to be with Ralph again, because he's grown a great deal in the past couple of years. And then there was sadnesses for me, seeing people who I was with at a time when we were all growing, and then coming back and seeing that they haven't grown, and that they're sort of living out. It's like the high school football player who can't stop being a football player, you know, even though it's all over. And that was a little sad. I really got great delight out of Hofmann's style. When I met him back in Basel, Switzerland, in 60, whenever that was, 3, 4, somewhere around there, two. He was very guarded and very conservative, and I thought he was going to play that role when he came here. But at the dinner party before the evening lecture, when all of the, you know, guests were sitting around, and he stood up at the end of the table and he said, "I don't feel like the president of a corporation, but I do feel like a grandfather, and I feel like this is my family." That was there was a quality of warmth and love and allowing the existence of this phenomenon, which he has to be busy explaining as the hysteria of psychedelics. At the same moment, he honors that he's fed it. Right? So it was a family interesting, and he put it all into perspective. I mean, it put Tim's role into perspective too, because Tim is certainly the person who most precipitated its explosion in the West, you know, prior to Ken Kesey's acid tests and so on, things like that. I mean, Tim was definitely the one that did that. But Hoffman in the background was this giant who, you know, who had, as you could hear in his lecture, just had incredible courage of self. Later, when we were doing experimentations on ourselves, by then he had already done all that, so ours was a different level completely, you know. Although there were memories of the drama of his experience when I was thinking just now of, just came to mind. When LSD first came to Boston, we were all using psilocybin, which is a very mild psychedelic. That was our first year of research with psilocybin. And Michael Hollingshead brought a large bottle of sugar water, sort of thick sugar, which was from England, I believe. And we were told it was a tablespoon worth, right? And Tim took the first tablespoon along with, I think, Maynard and Flo Ferguson, I'm not sure. And 5 days later, Tim hadn't spoken yet. You know? And I, therefore, as the second in command, felt we had lost Timothy. Right? So I prohibited all further use of this monstrous chemical, whatever it was. It was, you know, Timothy was such a promising fellow and we just lost him. And but that turned out to be my kind of conservative old lady quality that Timothy has criticized me for.
Last 5 days of silence.
So that's my reaction to the weekend.
It was interesting that that when Dr. Hoffman appeared that evening, that there was a standing ovation. Mm-hmm. And I think it took him a few minutes to understand the extent of the gratitude that ovation was representing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people feel that toward Tim and mm-hmm. toward yourself.
Yeah.
That it was the doorway for a great many people.
I agree.
Today I had the opportunity to speak with someone who's been heavily into study of the Bhagavad Gita and meditation regularly and mantra. And I mentioned the conference to him, and he said, "Oh, that's amazing." He said, "It's just 10 years to the day that I first took LSD." Hmm. And he said it in such a way that it was a bit like a fond memory, but totally dismissing it. And tending to feel that it's best if it's not used at all any longer. And I just posed to him, I said, it's been the doorway for so many people that I wonder how much of the tenor of our times is dictated by the fact that people have not been exposed to it, that it's not readily available, that it's not part of the social structure at the moment. And how much that accounts for the fact that things have moved to punk rock and hate and all of the negativities that we're beginning to see rampant among the youth now, as opposed to the love generation and all the positivity that existed then.
First of all, you've got to separate out fads from true processes that are going on in a kind of an evolutionary sense. And a lot of the love generation was just as impure as the punk rock is now. These are kind of fads, they're fashions. And I don't think that the punk rock people are in their deepest beings are any different than we are, and the love people weren't as loving as they seemed to be. And when we watched the New Age businesses begin, we saw that they were often as cutthroat as anybody else, and that a lot of people, when they came back into living in the world, weren't necessarily much more humane or compassionate in their dealings than they had been before. I mean, it's not an either-or proposition at all. And I think it would have been beautiful. I mean, there are a lot of ifs, would have fantasies about how the culture could be. But in a way, you've got to understand that we are all of it, and that if it went the way it is, it's because of who we are. And I mean, I remember in 66, whenever I did that book with Sidney Cohen on LSD, that paperback for New American Library, I suggested a licensing program and centers where, just like you'd learn to fly, you know, same thing as getting a pilot's license, you could get certified to do exploration with psychedelics. And I think had there been some more socially acceptable vehicle, perhaps more of the what we call the middle class would have participated more extensively, and there may have been more dramatic shifts in social institutions since they rule and guide so many of them. At the same moment, the people that were really intensely desirous of changing consciousness strongly enough overrode most of the legal issues and the issues of obtaining. I really don't think that many people who were preoccupied with getting free stopped. I mean, look at the usage of cocaine. Look at the usage. These are all illegal drugs, marijuana. I mean, illegality hasn't seemed to stop in prohibition. It didn't stop people from drinking. I think that it added an element of paranoia to the scene, which was unfortunate. I mean, I think that the setting, the set, is so important in taking drugs, and when you're afraid that when you're doing something illegal, it just makes it more difficult to get rid of the paranoid set. But lots of people that really wanted to grow have used it, and my own feeling is I wouldn't want to be anybody to keep somebody else from doing whatever they want with their consciousness. I mean, that was the article Tim and I wrote back in the Harvard Review back in the early 60s, The Politics of Consciousness, that people should have a right to legislate about their own consciousness as long as they don't hurt another person. And what I saw in the conference was all the activists were ready to sign things and start groups and join, and that's the old revolutionary stance. It's us against them, and the government is them, and us is us. But the government isn't them. The government is us, too. And the interesting process is, as LSD has become less a focal issue, the whole thing's been loosening subtly anyway, as one guy said, although he didn't quite fit in with the zeitgeist of the moment, and so everybody sort of hushed him up. But he, in effect, was saying, it seems like the FDA is opening it up. There's more opportunity for research. They're looking around for good projects. And I got a feeling like as the crisis wears off, I mean, I know guys in the FDA. They're not them, you know. They're not bad guys. So maybe I'm the kind of guy that stops process. I don't know, because I'm so, I'm not that way enough. I don't know.
So you feel that the activism may indeed hamper...
I think it'll just force everybody to take a stand.
And
a government bureaucrat has to take a stand of conservatism. He's got to do it. It's his job. He doesn't have any choice. There are no options for him. So if you don't push anybody to the wall, it all can work out much better than if you start to polarize the thing. And that's the same thing. And I think that in that way, the conference... I'd like it to have very low press, in a sense, you know. I mean, I'd rather have it just be part of the whole process of LSD, because I think it was an interesting statement that the acid on the street is good acid, and also that there's plenty of it. I think that's a very interesting thing, and so that if people want to take it, it's around. And certainly, whoever they're getting cocaine from and marijuana, they can probably get acid from, too. So. Everybody's got their friendly neighborhood pusher.
But you have some of the original. So I've heard.
Not anymore.
Not anymore? That was the last of it in Bali.
I have a few historical things, like the original, some original blue tabs that were made by a friend of mine, and just put away. They have no power anymore, but I just kept them as kind of a historical memory. But I don't have everything else is gone. I gave it all away in Bali.
Obviously, if you have used it approximately once a year, you use it with a high level of consciousness, and you very carefully consider the circumstances and why you're doing it. Would you recommend that for anyone that's using it? That it's not a recreational drug, as some were calling it?
Well, again, I don't want to legislate about how other people live their lives, and I certainly enjoy recreation as well as the next person does. It feels to me that it's underusing something. It's like taking a jet plane to go to the grocery store.
Wasting.
That it's sad that we couldn't find a sacramental ritual connected with it that would be strong enough to create a set for people to be able to go deep within themselves with it or deep into the universe. That most people take it and then create a setting that offsets the effect of it. So they're really wasting it. They're really wasting because they're going for super sensual and super relational type experiences. And it's just much more than that. But it isn't unless you use it that way, unless you have a right set. And I think that my guru's instructions to me really define my game. And I just don't have any choice in my head. He said, if you're alone, that's a heavy one. If you're alone, if you're feeling much peace, if you're in a cool place, I never understood that one, but he said it, if you're in a cool place and your mind is turned towards God, you can take your yogi medicine. Right? That was his instruction. And so that's defined the game, because a lot of times people have come along and say, won't you take acid with me? Or what do you say? Let's take acid. I can't. I've got these rules. I use them as a device because I'm aware of how much you share karma with another human being when you take LSD with them. You know? I'm much more careful about consciousness because I really like to get free rather than adding more stuff in all the time, you know. And so it's very, very easy to form what we used to call imprints, but what you could call in Buddhism term more attachments or clinging through an LSD experience, because of the intensity with which you relate to something.
Something or someone.
Something or someone. You know.
So. Now this is not, you're taking it with someone, not taking it in the presence of a guide, as was the original suggestion.
If an individual for the first time were taking it for the first time, I would recommend they have a guide. And I would recommend that be somebody that has taken LSD enough so that they are very, very cool about all possibilities. There is really no reason in the culture with the knowledge we have now for anybody to have a bad trip. The bad trip will be created by the paranoia that they bring into the session or the setting. And if they have a guide and they are not straight with their guide prior to the situation, then it could be a horrible nightmare still, right? Because when you start to, quote, lose control, your control mechanisms, if there is something you're hiding, it gets very scary. Right? The most dramatic example I ever had of that was when I was guiding a session for a man who the motives were impure. I knew we didn't have the right relationship, but he had a lot of money, and I was running a big scene at Millbrook, and I had to go and guide sessions. That was my business at that time. And I had this session with this man, and he started to get more and more frightened as it went on, and he went into a total, he flipped into a total hallucination, it would seem, in which he relived the situation in which he and his wife had murdered her father, right, for the money. Then he came back, not knowing whether indeed he had said this or merely thought it, right? Not knowing whether I knew it or not. No way to ask me, of course. You understand that, the dynamics of that situation. And the rest of the session was a horror show. I mean, it was just total paranoia for the rest of the evening. You know? And so he has since been shot to death, so that whole issue is a past issue now. So
heavy
I...
A heavy trip,
yes. But what I often did was, as I got more thoughtful about it, sometime I'd be with somebody for weeks who would come to have an LSD trip, and then at the end of a couple of weeks I'd say, I'm sorry, we can't have it because we don't have the kind of rapport where I feel absolutely safe that wherever you go, I can go with you, that you'll take me with you. And, of course, crises have occurred. I mean, dramatic moments have occurred where I've sort of lost somebody for a while and had to go out and find them. I mean, I'm talking about planes of consciousness, you know, but generally, if you have a guide, you're calm, and you really want to explore your inner being, I still see LSD as an incredible vehicle for overriding your habitual response patterns, your habits of thought, and giving you a free slate to experience your innocence of consciousness once again. Even, albeit, it's just karmic setting aside, and it's only for a moment, and all that.
And, could you go into that a little more deeply? Just exactly what you mean by that?
Well, you develop what we call ego, which is a structure. It's like a matrix for defining the universe of who we are and who everybody else is and how it all works, so on. And that matrix allows for efficiency. It allows for survival on the physical plane. At the same moment, it's only one of an infinite variety of ways of perceiving any moment, right? And if you had... if you were free, you could put that model into your computer to use for a functional purpose. But then when you were finished, you could take it out, like you can put those paragraphs into that typewriter and it'll print out a typewriter, and then you take them out again, you know. And you would be able to always have a computer that had no fixed program in it. It would be like a floating program, and the needs of the situation would determine which program went into the computer, right? But because of the emotional learning that occurs in our original structure where parents teach children, and the emotional way it's taught, because it's usually non-conceptual first, it's emotional feeling structure is at the root of our structure of the universe, there is a very over-learned, over-reinforced model, and it's very, very hard to get outside of it. And what usually gets people outside of it is childbirth, or an automobile accident, or losing a loved one, or approaching death, or for some women, at time of their period, or there's some, you know, a love affair, something like that will break the set for a moment. And many people then treat that as confusion, or as psychosis, or hallucination, or something.
Basically shock or crisis.
Yeah. Trauma, as Freud would talk about. Mm-hmm. Now, what LSD does is it really... at the synaptic level, at the neural connection level, it neutralizes, it puts the computer back into neutral, in a way. It doesn't define which way you will go. Then, that's why the setting is so important, and the set is so important, because it defines what programs go into your head during those sessions. Then, as the chemical wears off, the old habitual patterns reassert themselves, but as they do, your awareness can watch them reassert themselves, which gives you a little leverage on them, and a little bit, say, aha, here I go. It's like when you fly, and you go up above the smog, and then you come into Los Angeles somewhere, and you start to go back down in. If you were just living in the smog, you wouldn't notice it. You might notice in your throat, but in your eyes. But, I mean, generally, you don't see how yellow it all is till you've been out in the blue sky for a few hours. Then you say, okay, here I go back down in again, right? And you can feel the thing thickening and hardening and stopping and locking in again. And when you're done with LSD is when there is no lock-in anymore. And when my guru took LSD and nothing happened, it's because there is no lock-in. There's no place he's got to go from, since there's no place he's holding. Okay, is that what you...
That's beautiful, thank you. That really articulates something that I never have been able to do. That's precisely what happens.
Now, what we did was, in the early 60s, we really were attempting to, what we call, re-imprint people. Like, we would work in the Concord prison, or Tim and Ralph did, I didn't actually. But I helped in the design of things. They would go in and they would take somebody who, like, the recidivism rate in that prison was over 70%. The 70% probability those guys are going to be back in prison within a year for doing the same thing again. And we would go into the medical installation there and turn them on with psilocybin. And then, as they went out, show them, as they came back in, the game and the losing strategy that they were attached to. The theory being they would have a new, quote, imprint, or a new set of patterns, or a new perception about it. We were never either systematic about it, or what we later, I feel more, is that... That getting high and seeing is only one part of the whole process of change. And it isn't, at first we thought that because we had seen through, we would never get stuck again. And then as I look, here it is 12 years later, Timothy's still Timothy and I'm still me. And you could say, well, it's different though, because Timothy isn't really Timothy and I'm not really me. Well, before Timothy was really Timothy, you understand the distinction? But actually, when I met those people this weekend, there was still a lot of solidity in them. None of them were like my guru. I mean, I didn't feel any of them were nobody special. They were getting there, they're getting closer. But there was still the somebodyness in everybody, there's still the thing. Now, it's a long way up from a tremendous cultural overlearning to get free. But my feeling is that it... That attachment to any external form, any method at all, we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, is just still attachment. And ultimately, certain kinds of inner processes have to go on, other than just getting high, in order to bring about change in life.
But that's precisely what you're talking about when you speak of grist for the mill. It's just more grist for the mill. It's that... Non-attachment, yeah. Such a dangerous word, and yet that's...
Well, I love it because it is so dangerous. I mean, I love the way it infuriates people. What do you mean not to be attached? Because they think of it as not involved, and I mean totally involved but not attached. And it's I'd like to save the word because it has a very specific meaning of not clinging to things.
It
doing
is the
them
card
fully,
that you put into the machine to write the paragraph.
Exactly, it's just that. And it's for me, I'm like a rent-a-body or a rent-a-roll or, I don't know who I am. I don't even care who I am. I don't even care how it all comes out. It's none of my business. I'm really part of a process. It's like the river doesn't care where it goes. It's going to the sea. It's fine. What word did you use instead of non-attachment before that?
Okay. You got me.
Gotcha. You don't have a memory either.
Just don't hold on to it.
There was a lightening, though, that is apparent in people who have been even taking psychedelics. There is a loosening of the hold of any single reality, any single definition of themselves or anything else in the universe. And what we've watched is the social implications of that loosening of the hold. I mean, what we did was we went from like Newtonian to Einsteinian physics in the social psychological domain, going from absolute to relative realities. And it has a tremendous cultural upheaval because you don't have a linear value system which you can lay from one generation to another, because the kids were countering their parents with other value systems that weren't just revolutionary. They just weren't the opposite of the thing for breaking away. They were really other value systems that were orthogonal to the ones that the parents had held. And that's what makes the culture a much more mature culture in a way, because it's much more available to alternative realities within it.
It is a real evolutionary process.
Yeah, that's really an evolutionary process. But see, from the evolutionary point of view, I don't think a hell of a lot ever happens, really. I mean, I think that any one entity evolves, but when you look at the cross-section of the total, all incarnates on the physical plane, I think they always represent the cross-section of new beings and old beings and middle beings. And the reason people incarnate on the physical plane is because of lust, greed, agitation, sloth and torpor, and doubt. I mean, the five hindrances in Buddhism. And that's who we are. That's what we're doing here. So,
I mean, it's a process of burning those things away.
That's it. And when you finish burning them away, you don't incarnate in the human on the physical plane anyway. So the whole idea of making heaven on earth always seems to me like it's a hype in a way, because there is a heaven. This is earth. I mean, it's like changing. Let's make elementary school into junior high school. You know, but then what's going to happen to all the people that need to go to elementary school? There are really functional reasons why this game is the way it is. I mean, I think that it's to say this is bad is to say, God, you blew it. And if you had done it right, this would be junior high school.
But that doesn't preclude struggling to make things better.
That's the Bodhisattva paradox. As far as I'm concerned, the paradox is that this plane is what it is, and it's perfect just the way it is, and there is nothing that you do other than to work to make it better and to end the suffering, even though you know that it's perfect the way it is. And the perfection includes your working full-time to end the suffering. And that's there's a beauty in that paradox, an absolute exquisiteness in that paradox, because every time you get too far over on one side, the other pulls you. You get too far, because if you get into the, oh, it's all perfect, screw it, I'm just going to lie around, smoke dope, and screw, and exploit the culture, and get my welfare checks. You get too far over from the other side, we got to do it. Why aren't you protesting? Let's go out, you know. And you've always got to find the balance between those things. You know? And it's you always pit one when somebody comes up too righteous in their activism. Don't you see it's all perfect? That infuriates them, right? Somebody's lying around in the perfection of it all. What about ending suffering? Don't you see all those people are suffering? Yeah. And that little smile on the corner of the mouth of the Buddha, the unbearable smile of unbearable compassion. Oh, God.
Looks like you can taste it. No,
I live with it all day, right, every day. Yeah.
No, that pendulum swing in the last 10 years or so seems to be less extreme. You mentioned many of the hip generation going into business, and it's not the extreme.
Yeah.
They may dabble in a sort of, you called it ruthless, I don't think it's quite that, of entering the world full hog, you know, to make a success and make a buck. It seems to just swing into that area, and then it's modified by consciousness.
That's exactly right. Absolutely right. I don't mean all New Age business is ruthless, by the way.
No, I know you don't.
But I think you're absolutely right that we go through the pendulum process, and then the pendulum gets gentler and gentler and gentler.
It seems to be true in the other direction, too, of swinging toward overt spirituality.
Yeah.
That it's not swinging all the way in, so that it's all-encompassing, you know, and just everyone's withdrawing.
I think what is going on is so fantastically mind-blowing. I mean, just the thing I dreamed of in my dream is happening.
So that it's all-encompassing, I
think what is going on is so fantastically mind-blowing. I mean, just the thing I dreamed of in my dream is happening, in that we are transcending the need to define our state of consciousness by external forms.
Right.
And that's the thing I call the Martian takeover. That is, we are, the consciousness shifts, but people can continue to dance within the social structure and the civilization, wearing exactly, doing the same forms, wearing the same facade, but the inner being has changed. And so the whole idea of New Age isn't as relevant, because there's the old age. People can be doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs, but they are doing it from a whole different space. And that took a lot of that pendulum swinging before that happened. Because it went to beads and white clothes, and then to the beer parlor, and the screw it all, I'm just going to get, you know, stoned all the time. And then it just kept going back and forth and back and forth until pretty soon you meet people who say, even many people who say, well, I don't have any practice. But yet as you talk to them, we're right here, their heart is open, their mind is quieting, it's all getting lighter and emptier for them. I said to Kala Rinpoche the other day in Santa Fe, I said, I know that the practices are all important and the tradition is important, but I said, I go around the country, around the world now, and I keep meeting myself everywhere. I keep meeting all of us here and there, and I never have to talk down to people. Everybody's always right here. I don't understand it. If all the practices were so important, what are they doing there? Because they didn't do the practice. What right have they got to be that? He countered with a beautiful up-level with, yes, but if they wish to get finished in this birth. I said, well, I don't know anything about things like that. I said, I just teach low grade. That was a beautiful dialogue.
You've been out of the country, visiting Thailand and Bali. Perhaps you could share a little bit about your journey.
Well, I'll just do a few incidents and vignettes rather than a chronological thing. Bali is a extraordinarily interesting country. The Balinese, because it's